From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Larry Flint, the infamous pornographer who went as high as the Supreme Court in his defense of free speech. His life is examined in the new movie, The People vs. Larry Flint, in which he's portrayed by Woody Harrelson. And Flint has his own memoir, An Unseemly Man, My Life as a Pornographer, Pundit, and Social Outcast. Also, we remember a man who became a pioneer in America's right to die debate. Joseph Quinlan died on Saturday. He and his wife won the right to have their comatose daughter, Karen Ann Quinlan, disconnected from her ventilator. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel by South African writer Andre Brink. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Some of the nation's largest airlines will install fire detectors in their cargo holds. This comes after the ValueJet crash into the Everglades last May. Federal regulators are considering even stricter safety rules. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Investigators haven't formally named a cause of the ValueJet crash, but suspicion centers on used oxygen bottles which may have caught fire in the cargo hold. Flight data recorders indicate the crew never knew what was happening until smoke and fire filled the cabin. President Clinton says the airlines will now install detectors in 3,700 aircraft.
By putting smoke detectors in every cargo hold of these carriers, we take another step to make our people and our skies safer.
In the past, airlines have said cargo fires happen too rarely to justify the expense of smoke detectors, up to $400 million. And the airlines declined to take an even more expensive step recommended by federal officials. Most planes will not have fire suppression systems, which would allow pilots to put out a cargo hold fire once they detect it. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
There are conflicting opinions at the White House over the budget for 1998. Outgoing Housing Secretary Henry Cisneros is fearful the new Clinton administration will permit deep cuts in housing programs for the poor. He wrote a memo about it to the Office of Management and Budget, which was leaked to the Wall Street Journal. A group of Northeast lawmakers has also asked the president not to cut deeply into heating subsidies for the poor. White House spokesman Mike McCurry says economic advisors are working to protect safety net programs while still trying to win support from the Republican-led Congress. The government says inflation at the consumer level remained well-behaved in November. NPR's John Itzie reports.
The consumer price index rose 0.3% last month. The increase was mostly due to higher fuel costs. Excluding the volatile food and energy sectors, consumer inflation in November was just 0.2%. That core rate, the one watched most closely for signs of growing inflationary pressure, is rising even slower than it did last year. Also today, the government said retail sales in November dropped 0.4%. The weakness early in the Christmas shopping season was a surprise, but it was mostly due to weaker auto sales. The signs of moderate growth and inflation suggest that the Federal Reserve will leave short-term interest rates at current levels when policymakers meet on Tuesday. I'm John Itzie in Washington.
Avis Rent-A-Car is trying to end ties with the North Carolina franchise owner over racial bias. Owner John Dalton's accused of refusing to rent cars to black customers. Three black women filed suit against him and Avis last month, claiming he instructed employees not to lease to blacks and that Avis executives knew about his actions. Dalton denies ever discriminating against anyone. On Wall Street, the Dow's down 13 points at 6,389. This is NPR. Tension in the West Bank has increased following the murders of an Israeli woman and her son. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke at their funeral today, saying he would continue to deepen Jewish roots in the Palestinian territory. A group called the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine claimed responsibility for yesterday's murders. The group opposes Israeli-Palestinian peace accords and links the attack to increased Jewish settlement in the territory. Palestinian security forces reportedly arrested about 15 group members in connection with the slayings. U.S. Marine officials say a fighter attack plane on a training mission was forced to dump a 1,000-pound bomb into the ocean off the island of Okinawa. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The FA-18 had tried repeatedly, according to Marine Corps authorities, to release the bomb during an annual training exercise known this year as Beechcrest 97. The target was a tiny island 60 miles west of Okinawa called Whiskey 176, where training runs are made. The aircraft was said to be running low on fuel, and it was directed to drop the bomb over water. The pilot switched the bomb to safe and jettisoned it from an altitude of 500 feet. It did not detonate, and authorities say the bomb, which was not activated, should not explode. A Marine Corps spokeswoman said authorities are looking at appropriate measures to retrieve it. More than 1,000 U.S. military personnel are taking part in the week-long exercise. The incident is under investigation. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Relief officials in Central Africa say 200,000 Rwandan refugees are on the move in Tanzania, but it's not clear if they're going home. Most are said to be ethnic Hutus. Rwanda is now controlled by ethnic Tutsis, and many Hutus fear retribution by them. The Hutu refugees cannot stay in Tanzania either. That country has demanded they leave by the end of the year. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Once again, people are trying to figure out what to make of Larry Flint, who is my guest. Is he a sleazebag, a pioneering free speech advocate, a lunatic, all of the above? His life is examined in the new film, The People vs. Larry Flint, starring Woody Harrelson as Flint, and in his new memoir, An Unseemly Man. Both chart his rise from bar owner to publisher of the taboo-breaking magazine Hustler, which launched his magazine empire. Much of the film focuses on Flint's First Amendment court battles, defending his explicit nude photographs and raunchy cartoons and satires. He went as high as the Supreme Court and won. During one of his court battles in 1978, he was shot by a would-be assassin, leaving his legs paralyzed and his speech slurred. Before we begin, be advised that we're going to be talking about adult subject matter, which may even make some adults uncomfortable. I asked Flint first for his reaction to the new film.
I like the movie an awful lot. I would like it even if it wasn't about me. I just think it was really fantastic. I was surprised that Columbia wanted to make the picture. I didn't know if the timing was right or not, because normally they don't make biopics about people who are alive. They're usually dead, because people are concerned about their image as to how they're portrayed on the big screen. But I said, it's my life. It happened. Do it. Just get it right. And I worked as a script consulting with him, but I didn't have any casting or script approval, and I didn't want it. I felt that the director, Milos Forman, should make the movie as he's seen it. And
Do you see yourself any differently, watching yourself as portrayed in the movie? Do you feel any differently about any of your past actions watching the movie, or...
No, because they took very few creative liberties in making this movie. It's relatively accurate. It was very painful to watch some of it, like my shooting and the death of my wife. But I've dealt with all of that, and I'm happy that the movie's been made and that I've written the book, because everyone knows me. They know I publish Hustler, but they know little about how the last couple of decades unfolded in terms of the various legal cases that I was involved in, and many of the controversies surrounding my life. So I think the movie and the book will put everything in the proper perspective for those who are interested.
A lot of the movie revolves around your free speech trials and the ambivalence that a lot of civil libertarians had about you. They wanted to defend your rights and thereby protect the rights of everybody, but a lot of those people who wanted to protect your rights didn't particularly like your publications. How important is the First Amendment to you? I mean, I guess to put it bluntly, do you see your trials for you as having been more a matter of principle or more a matter about the ability to make a lot of money?
Well, when I first started out, I was only interested in making money and wanted to have fun at what I was doing. I think I had to stand in a courtroom and listen to a judge sentence me to 25 years in prison before I realized that freedom of expression was something that could no longer be taken for granted. You know, a free press is not freedom for the thought you love, but rather for the thought you hate the most. And when the Founding Fathers wrote the First Amendment, they didn't qualify it. They simply said, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press. While some people might find certain publications, such as Hustler or others, offensive, that's the price they have to pay to live in a free society, and that's toleration. People have to tolerate the Larry Flints of the world so they can be free. And it's magazines like Hustler that need protection of the First Amendment, not Time or Newsweek, because they're not going to offend anyone. And freedom's only important if it's offensive.
Well, just to put in a word here, I think mainstream publications have had their run-ins with the courts over free speech issues, too. But in the movie, your lawyer is depicted as just getting fed up with you sometimes and some of your antics in court. Your stunts in court, as depicted in the movie, are the time when you wore a diaper to court, which I know you did in real life, and a time when you were fined $10,000 for withholding a source in contempt of court. And then you had models show up with trash bags filled with the cash, which they dumped on the floor of the courtroom. Did that actually happen too, the $10,000?
Yes, and of course the diaper was made out of an American flag. But there's an interesting story behind that. Annie Leibovitz, a photographer of Vanity Fair, was photographing me for a feature for the magazine. She wanted me draped on my couch in an American flag. My attorney calls me and says, you've got to be in court in an hour. And I said, I can't do it. He said, if you don't, the judge is going to hold you in contempt. By this time, I was so fed up the way they were treating me in terms of trying to force me to reveal my source, because I felt if I was CBS or the Washington Post, it wouldn't have even been an issue. And I just said, you know, if they're going to treat me like a kid, I'll act like one. And that was the reason for my bizarre behavior. And I'm not saying it's justified. I'm not even saying it's appropriate. I probably wouldn't even do it if I had it to do over again. But those are my motivations for what happened.
At a time when your lawyer was so fed up with you, he was ready to just give up on you and sever professional relations, he said to you, at least in the movie he said to you, that you claim to be defending the First Amendment, yet you show no respect for the courts that are supposed to uphold it. And I'm wondering what you think about that. You know, someone who has been in all these First Amendment trials and who, in fact, showed very little respect for the court.
I think the point that he made was interesting, and it actually happened. And I don't disagree with his position, but by the time we had had this discussion, I'd already been shot and paralyzed during an obscenity trial in Georgia. I didn't really give a damn at that point about the Supreme Court or any other court, because my attitude was, you know, what are you going to do to me now? Kill me? I mean, that was the reason why I so vigilantly fought that battle all the way.
It wasn't the courts that shot you.
Well, that's true. It wasn't. But it was 5 years before the government ever revealed the name of the man who shot me. I felt there was a great many members of the establishment that was sort of happy to see me shot on that street in Georgia that day.
Tell us what you publish now. Give us a sense of the number of magazines, which magazines you publish and distribute.
I publish over 20 magazines now. Only six of them are adult titles. I have two music magazines, Rip and Rap Pages. I do two boating magazines. I do some computer magazines. All mainstream publications.
Before you started publishing men's magazines, you ran several bars, which became go-go bars, with, I believe, topless dancers. Who were the men you were going after? Did you have a very conscious approach toward figuring out who your clientele was going to be and how you were going to attract them?
You mean in the clubs or the magazine?
In the clubs.
we primarily cater to the traveling businessman who we felt would rather spend the evening watching a pretty girl dance or having a drink in the club than stand in his hotel room and possibly watching the Johnny Carson show. That was the primary focus of our clientele, and the clubs were quite successful.
When you launched Hustler magazine in 1974, how did you want it to be different from other men's magazines? Specifically, how did you see it in relationship to Playboy, which was the best known, most popular?
Well, I always felt and still feel that Playboy presents women that give an unattainable fantasy to men. You know, the 6-foot-tall blonde with a 40-inch bust and a very plastic-looking setting. I felt guys wanted to see more of, you know, the girl next door, whether she might have small breasts, medium or large, or be a brunette or a blonde. The type of girl you might even see at your local market. And this had a lot to do with the mass appeal of Hustler. And, of course, I didn't have a formal education when I started, so I wasn't trying to portray myself as any sort of literary giant. I just wanted to appeal, to the average guy. And that's what I did. We created humor for Hustler, which is considered tasteless and lowbrow and many times offensive, but it's the type of humor that you hear and see in the workplace, in the factories. And also the magazine had a great deal of political satire and political overtones where we were, always lampooning the politicians. And basically it was the political satire that really got us in trouble more so than the photo features that we were publishing.
My guest is Larry Flint. The movie about him opens December 27th. His new memoir is called An Unseemly Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Larry Flint. He has a new memoir called An Unseemly Man, My Life as Pornographer, Pundit, and Social Outcast. Your first so-called pink issue, in which a woman was photographed graphically with her legs spread, was in November of 1974. What made you go in that direction? How did you decide to go in that direction?
A female genitalia is the most erotic part of the female body. And that's what the man wants to see. To the man, it's a flower. And men are spending their whole life trying to get back into where they came from.
I'm wondering if you felt that a lot of men, and say teenagers, bought the magazine in a way out of curiosity because they'd never seen a detailed photograph of a woman like that before, and they wanted to know what it looked like?
I've never been asked that question. It's a very good possibility. No doubt when they buy their first issue, it's from curiosity. But I remember in the very beginning, when I first started Hustler and first did the first pink shots, I was with my lawyer, not the one in the movie in the case, but a different lawyer, having dinner at his house one night. He must have been 60, 65 years old. His wife was the same age. And she had looked at the magazine, and she made a comment at the dinner table. She said, I never realized that I looked like that down there. That was a statement that stayed with me over the years. And I don't think women see this part of their anatomy as being beautiful and erotic, but men do.
I'm wondering if when you started photographing pink, whether you had to develop a kind of photographic language for it. I mean, what I mean is that because it wasn't, because women weren't shown like that before, there wasn't a kind of set of ideas about what the right erotic way of display was.
That part of the body is, we felt, also needed to be well-groomed. That, in a sense, a woman's vagina had as much personality as her face. And we just wanted the photography to bring this out. So it was as much concerned about how her genitalia looked as we were about how her face looked.
When you started photographing women's genitals for Hustler, in a way you were photographing a perfected ideal of women's bodies, in the sense that, I mean, you started to create this language of what women should look like, shaved in a certain way and probably prepped in a certain way. I'm wondering, why shaved?
Well, you know, that's very interesting, because what has happened over the last two decades is 20 years ago, men thought it was a great deal more erotic appeal that the pubic hair was there. The bushier, the better. And now, with the new generation that's coming along, you know, it's completely the opposite. You see many girls, you know, and not just because of their job or because of going to the beach or what have you, are shaving on a regular basis because younger men are preferring this. Now, if you took a poll in men over 40, you would get the complete opposite that you would for men under 40.
As you know, Hustler magazine has been criticized for being sexist, for being insulting to women. Do you think the magazine condescends to women? Or, you know, just presents them as sex objects in a condescending or insulting way?
Women are their most glorious in their birthday suit, and that's the way men want to see them. And
let's stop. What does that mean? Women are most glorious when they're naked. What does that say about them when they're clothed? What do you mean?
No, I'm saying that's the way men want to see them. Now, you can talk about women being used as a sex symbol, exploited. You know, the feminist can preach this all day long, and it just doesn't change the fact that men love and adore women, and they see them as sexual objects. Now, don't get me wrong. That's not all that men see women as. You know, they like for some intelligence and compassion to come along with it. But I'm saying that women will always be a sex symbol, and that's human nature. And you're never going to be able to change that. And the feminists are going to have to learn to accept that. I think the women's movement has been good. It's came a long way. I believe in equal rights, equal pay, no discrimination. But I think women will always enjoy having car doors open for them. And I hope that the glorious dynams of the world have come to realize that many men are now willing to sleep on the wet spot.
Is that your idea of feminism? Men being able to sleep on the wet spot? Now, I have to ask you about a notorious cover for Hustler magazine that I guess to some women epitomized what they didn't like about the magazine. And it was the meat grinder cover, where you had a picture of a naked woman being put head first through a meat grinder with the caption, "Grade A Pink." What was the point of that?
Well, it was an effort at humor that we fell flat on.
I'll say.
It didn't work. It shouldn't have been done. It's a regret. But, hey, we all make mistakes. Every once in a while, you might screw a show up, you know? Sometimes we can't help it.
What was the point in your mind when you published it?
Well, it was intended to be humorous.
What was the joke?
Well, it was just so absurd and so outrageous that we felt people would laugh at it rather than to take it so seriously.
Now, you became a millionaire after publishing nude photographs of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. And while the merits of Hustler are surely, you know, debatable, publishing nude photos of someone against their will, that seems like, you know, just an invasion of privacy and a pretty reprehensible thing to do. And I'm wondering how you justify publishing nude photos of somebody when that person doesn't want those photos published.
Anyone that becomes a public figure gives up any right they have to privacy. Because if you're a public figure, you place yourself there because of your actions or your profession or your association. So being a public figure, you pay a price for that. And one of those prices is your privacy.
Well, there's a difference between this privacy and privacy. I mean, do you want to live in this kind of society where people are hiding in the bushes taking photographs of people who think that they're, you know, alone, taking photographs of them naked? And in a world where that could just be published and there's some kind of lofty principle to justify it?
Well, it raises the question of where are you going to draw the line in terms of a free press.
Right.
You can't give it to one person and not to another. You know, no system is perfect, and our system is not, but it is still yet the best in the world. But we amazingly have a free press that has worked quite well for 200 years, and it's got more efficient and better as time has gone by. I would hope, you know, that, you know, the matter of privacy could be dealt with in some manner that would not restrict freedom of press.
Larry Flint, he has a new memoir called An Unseemly Man. The movie about him opens December 27th. We'll talk a little bit more about his decision to publish those Jacqueline Onassis photographs in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, publisher of The Christmas Mystery, a holiday tale by Justine Garter, author of Sophie's World. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Larry Flint. Also, we remember a pioneer in the right to die debate, Joseph Quinlan, father of Karen Ann Quinlan. He died a few days ago. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel by South African writer Andre Brink. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Larry Flint. He's the subject of the new film, The People vs. Larry Flint, which stars Woody Harrelson as Flint. And he's written a memoir called An Unseemly Man, My Life as Pornographer, Pundit, and Social Outcast. When we left off, we were talking about the edition of Hustler magazine, which featured nude photos of Jacqueline Onassis and sold so well it made Flint a millionaire. I told him that's a perfect example of why he's such a problematic figure for First Amendment advocates. Yes, he's fought for free speech and almost lost his life in the process. But in the name of free speech, he does something repugnant, like publishing nude photos of a former First Lady. I asked him if decency, respect, empathy ever entered into his decision to publish those photos.
You know, I wish I had some remorse about the issue that you're discussing, but I don't. I think it's at all, you know, takes second place to the First Amendment, which gets its vitality and meaning from the unrestricted right of free choice.
Yeah, but just because there's a First Amendment and we want to uphold it doesn't mean you get off the hook that easily
First of all,
yeah,
we have libel laws. If you libel someone or make a statement of fact that's untrue, they can sue you and collect damages. Now, Jacqueline Onassis could have sued me. She chose not to, and she probably would have won. But that's the reason why I published the photographs, is I was gambling that she would not sue. But let's don't confuse the issue of libel with the issue of a free press. A free press does not give you the right to libel anyone. And in a famous case I have with the Reverend Jerry Falwell, the jury found they were no liable, but they still wanted me to pay him $200,000 for hurting his feelings. I took that case to the Supreme Court, and I won it. And I think it's important that I did win it for the nation, and I think the ramifications would have been absolutely horrible if it would have gone in the other direction.
If somebody was able to give you naked photographs of Hillary Clinton, would you print them?
In a heartbeat. You know, I could sell more nude photographs of Hillary Clinton than I could Cindy Crawford. You know, it's the controversy, the status symbol, the icon, you know, that they're buying. You know, they're buying a moment of sensationalism.
Exactly. And that's okay by you. So you'd have no compunctions if it were against her will, if she didn't know the photos were being taken, you'd have no compunctions to...
No, maybe Bill's got some old Polaroids laying around somewhere, you know.
Now, there was a period, I guess it was in the late 70s, when the president was Jimmy Carter, when his sister, Ruth Carter Stapleton, called you and basically tried to and succeeded in converting you to Christianity, and you were baptized. What was behind your conversion? Do you feel, looking back on it, that it was genuine on your part?
Well, first, I'm thankful I got over that, but the press again misrepresented that. Ruth Carter Stapleton really didn't have anything to do with the conversion. She was a very close friend, but it was a very profound and real experience that I had. Most people who go through these sort of spiritual experiences in their life, the only people they have to seek counsel from is family or neighbors or friend or local pastor. And fortunately, I was able to seek professional help to realize what I was going through. And I'm a classic manic depressive, and I truly believe I was just in one of my manic phases at the time this happened. And I know that's probably upset a lot of Christians out there living, but if these born-againers would just take a little lithium, you know, these visions would go away and the voices would disappear and they'd be okay.
So you're back to being an atheist?
Yes.
How long was your conversion? How long did it last?
Just a few months. Mm-hmm.
Larry Flint is my guest. You were shot in 1978 during an obscenity trial in Lawrenceville, Georgia. Can I ask you to remember for us what you remember of that moment when you were shot?
Well, it was a sunny summer day in a quaint little southern city, and it was the last thing we would ever expected to happen. And myself and my lawyer were both shot returning from a lunch break to the courthouse. And I didn't realize at the time how bad I was hurt, but I was almost 15 years fully recovering.
You've described the pain after being shot as feeling like you were being boiled alive.
Yes, you can't discuss pain with people that's never experienced it. We've all had headaches or bruised our thumb or stumped our toe. But until you've had nerve damage, you really don't know what real pain is. And I had to take painkillers for literally most of those years until a surgery was finally developed that would alleviate the pain.
So are you pain-free now?
Yes.
I'm wondering if during the period when you were in great pain and not interested in sex and not able to enjoy it in any way, if while you were publishing Hustler, you ever started to feel really detached from the subject matter and start to really wonder, why are people so obsessed with sexuality?
I never felt detached from the subject matter, but I felt very badly that I wasn't able to participate in the process of what we were doing with the company. But no, as far as sex itself goes, look, it's a medium that we use to communicate with more than anything else, and you would think we'd make a little bit better effort to understand it more. You know, you can run the most horrific photograph you want on the front page of a newspaper with mutilated, decapitated body, and they might even give you a Pulitzer Prize for it. But you run a photograph of a sexual image on the front page of that newspaper, and you could very well go to jail or be put out of business. So that says something significant about the priorities that we place on sex and violence.
You've been a very successful businessman running your magazines. Do you think your motivation has been, over the years, more sexual or more financial?
Oh, boy. My desire for sex was always in the forefront of my desire for money. I read a motivational book back in the 60s that said the same energy that you use for sex can be channeled into making you a successful business person. So I tried to adopt some of that philosophy.
Were men's magazines a part of your sexual coming of age?
No. I had not really paid any attention to men's magazines until I decided to publish Hustler nationally. And at that time, I made my observation.
Why do you think that you were uninterested in them as a person? I mean, you were obviously interested in them as a businessman, but just as a person, they were of no interest to you.
Well, it sounds strange, but I hadn't really seen them, and sex was a very, you know, predominant part of my life, and I never really felt the need to pursue these magazines. But the more I got into publishing Hustler, the more I came involved in sexuality and realized that pornography is really the purest form of art.
Larry Flint has written a new memoir called An Unseemly Man. The movie The People vs. Larry Flint opens December 27th. Tomorrow, we'll feature an interview with the director of the film, Milos Forman. Coming up, a new novel from South Africa. This is Fresh Air. South African novelist André Brink first made a name for himself in the 1960s as one of the new generation of Afrikaans writers who wanted their work to be more outspoken and political. In novels like States of Emergency and A Dry White Season, he described the moral disintegration that occurred under apartheid. His new novel, Imaginings of Sand, weds social commentary to the supernatural. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I'm ordinarily not a big fan of magical realism. All throughout Like Water for Chocolate, I'd catch myself thinking, transition needed every time a scene would switch from the mundane to the weird. Maybe my problem is that like old Ebenezer Scrooge at the beginning of A Christmas Carol, I get too caught up in asking literal-minded questions rather than just going along with the uncanny flow. So I took to heart the advice offered by one of the narrators in André Brink's new magical realist novel, Imaginings of Sand. As this narrator launches into yet another improbable saga, she tells her audience, "I'm not asking you to believe me. Just listen to me." That I found easy to do. Brink's novel, which is set in South Africa in 1994, on the eve of the first elections in which blacks were allowed to vote, is a startling fusion of fantasy and politics. The magical realist medium here is also a message. If blacks can finally vote in South Africa, Brink implicitly declares, then anything is possible, including ghostly visitations and women who change into trees. The outlandish sequence of events that makes up Imaginings of Sand is set into motion by a phone call. 33-year-old Christiane Mueller, an expatriate Afrikaner living in London, receives the call from her older sister Anna, who tells her that their 103-year-old grandmother, known as Uma, has been burned in a terrorist attack on her estate. Uma wants Christiane by her deathbed so that she can pass on the family stories. Christiane, a former anti-apartheid activist who left South Africa 12 years ago, never to return, says this about Uma and her request. "This was the one thing I'd always feared. This was the phantom limb which one day would begin to ache again." Full of dread, she catches the first flight back to Johannesburg. We readers know we're not in gray, rational London anymore the minute we approach Uma's partially burned mansion. A 19th-century mail-order monstrosity Christiane terms Boer Baroque. It features domes, turrets, and a secret room crammed with a lifetime's worth of used sanitary napkins. Uma is as eccentric as her house. Lying contentedly in the coffin she's ordered for herself, Uma rasps out wild tales about her female forebears, stories of witches, Amazons, and temptresses locked away in basements. Whenever Christiane leaves Uma's enchanted sick room, however, she's pulled back into the drama of the here and now. There's her sister Anna's abusive husband to contend with, and of course, the impending elections. Uma's stories swirl with dreamy, Chagall-like images. Still, nothing she describes equals the amazing picture Christiane paints of Election Day, when she and 20 black farm laborers cram into a hearse and ride to town to cast their votes together. Despite its euphoric moments, Imaginings of Sand is not without flaws. I don't subscribe to the identity politics school of literary criticism that says only Hispanic Americans can write about Hispanic Americans, gay men about gay men, etc. But Brink doesn't quite succeed here in creating genuine-sounding female conversations. But the narrative sweep of Imaginings of Sand is hard to resist. As the story nears its twin climaxes of Uma's death and the election, something unexpected happens. An event so terrible that, as Christiane says, nothing I could imagine could outdo this. Reality had canceled itself. In a novel so bizarre, that's quite a claim, but Christiane is not exaggerating.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Imaginings of Sand by André Brink. Joseph Quinlan, a pioneer of the Right to Die movement, died Saturday at the age of 71 of bone cancer. In 1975, his daughter Karen Ann Quinlan lapsed into a coma that doctors said she would never come out of. In a landmark court case, Joseph Quinlan and his wife Julia won the right to disconnect Karen from her respirator. But she continued to live in a coma for 9 more years before succumbing to pneumonia. Joseph and his wife Julia founded a hospice in Karen's name in New Jersey, and that is where Joseph died. When Joseph and Julia Quinlan joined us last April on the 20th anniversary of their legal decision, we were moved by the depth of their commitment to their daughter, their sustaining faith, and the grace with which they survived their ordeal. Joseph said he was the last person in the family to accept that Karen would never emerge from her coma.
I have a very strong faith, and I was still holding out for a miracle, praying a night and day for a miracle, and finally, I began to realize that there wasn't going to be any miracle, that this was just something that I would have to go through. And it was very difficult for me. And the only way I could possibly accept what was happening was, in my own mind, to place her in the loving, gentle hands of the Lord and ask him to use her as any way he wanted to reach anybody, any place in the world with his message. And when he was through, the only thing I asked is that he raise her up with him. And then that way I was able to accept it that, yes, we were going to lose Karen.
During the 9 years that your daughter remained in a coma in a nursing home, how much time were you able to spend with her? How much time did you feel you needed to spend with her?
Well, we visited her in our own time. I visited her generally after work in the afternoons. And sometimes my husband and I would visit her in the evenings. She was in a private room, and we were able to spend as much time with her as we wanted to. We were able to sit there and to play music for her, or to just talk to her, or to just sit by her bedside without worrying that our 5 minutes would be up, which is usually the problem in ICU,
right,
in the hospital, so that it was more relaxed. Of course, visiting Karen for the 9 years became our way of life. And we had accepted it.
I visited Karen every morning on my way into my business and and every evening on the way home. Now, it was altogether different from the hospital. It was a lot easier for me then in that her medical records were available to me. They had them set up at a little table. I'd sit down at a chair and take a look at her notes and see what kind of a night she had. I'd look at the nicest notes. And then in the evening, I'd see what kind of a day she had. And any questions at all, they would ask me. And it really took beautiful care of Karen, tying her and spotlessly clean. And they told the physician in charge that they would treat her like it was their own daughter, and they did.
You fought very hard to get your daughter taken off the respirator. You went to court for it. Then you fought the doctors when they still resisted you after the New Jersey Supreme Court decided in your favor. Did you at any point think that you should take her off the feeding tube that she was on when she remained in a coma for years after she was taken off the respirator?
You mean ourselves?
Well, to have the nursing home take her off the machine that was feeding her.
No, not really. We went up before an ethics committee before they admitted Karen, and they had the first time, I guess, the ethics committee was used any place in New Jersey, and they all stood around and they just asked us one question. What kind of care do you expect for us to give your daughter? And we answered that. We just expected normal care, comfort, palliative care. And they just looked at each other and they said, well, that's it. And it was so simple, the care that we was asking for. We never asked for anything additional, nor did we ever ask him to remove anything.
The questions about the feeding tube did not come into play until later. I think it was with the woman's name was Claire, and it was someplace in New Jersey. That's when they started to question the feeding tube. But that was a feeding tube that was placed in the stomach, because Karen was just fed through the nostrils. It was a gastro-nostril feeding tube. It was not perhaps what you're thinking of, the feeding tube where you go to court to ask to have that removed.
But she was getting fed through a tube through her nose?
Right, exactly. It was just the gastro feeding tube through the nose.
It was still like a machine that was keeping her alive by feeding her. She wasn't eating, obviously.
No, she couldn't eat, of course. It was...
So how did that seem different?
It was a pharmaceutical product, really.
Right.
You know, it wasn't food. People referred to it as food and water, and they make you feel bad because it's the most essential thing that you can do for your child is to give them food and water. But it wasn't food and water. It was a pharmaceutical product, a substitute for food, you see. But we still permitted it because... we never asked for that, and we didn't want to start asking for something else then.
No, why did you draw the line there? And did the medical establishment draw the line there as well, that it was one thing to take her off the respirator, it would be another thing to take away nutrition?
I mentioned to you how I resolved this in my own mind by placing her in the loving, gentle hands of the Lord, and I asked him to use her as his instrument to reach others and so forth. And in his time, when he was ready, I asked him to take her with him to his kingdom. Now, to me to go back years later and say, all right, God, I'm going to take over now and remove the feeding tube, knowing she would die, I just couldn't do that. I wanted to keep her in the Lord's hands and let him decide when she was going to go. And it was simply a matter of faith, that's all.
We're featuring an interview with Joseph and Julia Quinlan. Joseph Quinlan died Saturday of bone cancer. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview from earlier this year with Joseph and Julia Quinlan, pioneers in the Right to Die movement and parents of Karen Ann Quinlan. Joseph died Saturday of bone cancer. It sounds to me, Mr. Quinlan, from what you were saying before, that when you prayed to God, you didn't pray that your daughter live or that she be released from this netherworld that she was in, that you prayed that God would just do the right thing.
I felt he would use her as his instrument, as he always does use us, and I wanted him to use Karen, have something good come out of this, and then in his time, that's all, I asked him to take her, raise her up with him, and that's what I feel with all my heart he did. When finally Karen did leave this world, we were at her bedside, we received a call from the physician, and from the nurse, rather, who was told by the physician to call and suggest we come down as soon as possible. We were down there. Father Tom was had his forehead on her, had his hand on her forehead while he read out of his Bible, and Julie was holding a hand, and I was on the other side of the bed praying silently, standing, looking down at her when she stopped breathing. So beautiful, so peaceful, you know. We couldn't have asked for anything more.
Mr. and Mrs. Quinlan, you started a hospice that opened on April 15th, 1980, on the fifth anniversary of your daughter going into a coma. Tell me why you decided to start a hospice.
Well, when Karen was in the ICU unit, it's when I became aware of the patient's needs and also of their family's needs. As I had mentioned before, you were permitted to visit your loved one only 5 minutes on the hour or on the half hour. And you just sat in the waiting room, just waiting and waiting for the next half hour. And I just felt that there had to be a better way to, because you wanted those, that's the time when you want to spend with your loved one and to be able to hold your loved one, to be with them or her as often as possible. So we had received monies for the sale of our book and for the magazine articles, and of course we had no intentions of spending the money on ourselves, and we were looking for some memorial that we could put in Karen's name. Just by accident, I happened to read an article about Dr. Cecily Saunders, who formed the hospice in London. And when I was reading this, I realized hospice is the philosophy that we all believe in, that when a patient is terminal, that you just give them palliative, loving care. And my husband and I, then after that, for 3 years, we visited different hospices in this country. We met with Dr. Cecily Saunders in London, and we made the decision that we wanted to establish a hospice in memory to our daughter, Karen.
In many ways, you both helped to start the Right to Die debate in the Living Will movement. Do you think of yourselves in that way, as two of the people who helped start this?
Well, we don't really, but people call us the pioneers of it, yes. We have never, ever, and we still don't, consider ourselves as celebrities. We were just the parents of Karen, and we wanted to do what we felt was right for our loving daughter.
Julia and Joseph Quinlan recorded last April. Joseph died of bone cancer at the age of 71 Saturday at the hospice he and his wife founded in memory of their daughter Karen Ann Quinlan. Our senior producers today were Joan Tui Westman and Roberta Shirock. I'm Terry Gross, and I've been going through our ever-expanding collection of Christmas music, listening for some of the best and worst of the batch. We'll close with a wonderful recording of O Holy Night by soul singer Irma Thomas, featured on a Rounder anthology called Must Be Santa, the Rounder Christmas album.
O holy night, the stars are brightly shining, it is the night of the dear Savior's birth.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Milos Forman, director of The People vs. Larry Flint, talks about his own battles with censorship, and writer Dorothy Allison discusses her novel Bastard Out of Carolina. The movie adaptation premieres on Showtime TV this weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.